Welcome back to episode 45 of the Groups Matter podcast. I'm Brian Daniel here with Chris Surratt.
What's up?
Well, Chris, it's good to see you again.
I'm just excited to be here.
You keep coming back.
I know. You keep changing the locks and somebody keeps getting me in. I don't know how it works.
Every episode, I think, is this the episode that Chris just won't show up for. It's good to see you, bro.
It's good to be here.
Well, we are joined today by Barnabas Piper, who is an author, a podcast host, co-host a couple of times over, blogger, and just all-around good guy and someone that if you wanted to talk sports, you could, but he's pretty skewed.
What do you mean by skewed?
Well, you tend to skew more towards the hometown team. You may be a little lacking in objectivity, just based on what I've seen.
I think anybody from Minnesota is skewed just generally.
Yeah, well, I mean, when you spend 9 months out of the year trying not to die from frostbite, it does funny things to your brain.
When the only thing you have to do is go to an amusement park in a mall, there's something wrong.
I don't know that I've ever been to that amusement park. I've been through it before, but it's kind of... it's creepy.
You cannot overstate the impact of the weather in Minneapolis either, because I landed in a plane there one time, and the runway was dry. By the time I got in the rental car, it was iced. The whole city was iced over. In a matter of 35 minutes, the brakes were frozen. I couldn't stop. I had to really think ahead and coast to a stop. Never had that happen.
Last time I was in Minneapolis, it was a couple months ago. I got off the plane. I checked the weather, and it said it felt like -4. And so I got back on the plane.
You're just going to wait it out. Just take me back.
It's not worth it.
See, and my first thought is -4, and that's February. I'm pretty sure you were there for a conference. And I'm like, well, that's not bad. Yeah. Could be way worse.
Why do they hold the Bethlehem conference in, come on, there's warmer places.
Well, that's where the church is that started it. And
it
they do it in February because they only want people to come who really want to be there.
Oh, you got
to
suffer for Jesus. I get it.
Yeah, that's right. They're not making this easy on anybody.
I get it.
Well, you've already heard from Barnabas, but Chris, you want to give us an official introduction?
Absolutely. Barnabas Piper is the author of The Pastor's Kid, Finding Your Own Faith and Identity, which I totally resonate with because I'm a pastor's kid. I don't know that I found either one of those things, but he did, obviously. Help my unbelief.
It says finding. Like, that's an ongoing process.
It's a process. Yeah. Got it. Help my unbelief, why doubt is not the enemy of faith. And his newest one that we're going to talk about today a little bit is The Curious Christian, How Discovering Wonder Enriches Every Part of Life. So he also co-hosts the popular Happy Rant podcast and the 5 Leadership Questions podcast, which is extremely popular. Writes for the Blazing Center as well as numerous other publications and websites. And he speaks at churches and conferences around the country, and he lives right here in Music City and works, conveniently enough, a few floors up, I guess that would be, in Lifeway.
Yeah, I mean, so technically we're all coworkers, even though we work on very different projects.
Yes.
And he is live here in the Groups Matter podcast booth.
The closet.
The palatial Baptist studios of Lifeway.
There's some cool pictures you can take here with the wires and stuff, but it's not glamorous.
It's all in the theme of suffering for Jesus.
So welcome to the show, Barnabas. Thanks for making time today. I know you got a lot going on.
I'm glad you guys invited me. It's an honor. And since we're all being polite here, I'm going to go ahead and say that.
It is an honor. I mean, it's an honor for us. I'm flattered that you would say that. So so when are you going to invite me on to five leadership questions?
Run that one by Todd Adkins. I'm going to plead the fifth.
Nice.
Just pass the buck. That's what good leaders do, right?
All right. The Curious Christian, How Discovering Wonder Enriches Every Part of Your Life. Great title, by the way. How long has that been out?
It came out in March. So what now? Two and a half months?
Yeah. It's new.
I don't know what date it is.
So it's a great title. Tell us about how you got there. What's behind this book?
So the idea of the book is looking at curiosity it's really an examination of curiosity and then an examination of life through a lens of curiosity, which is not something that I think most adults think about very often. I think when we think of curiosity, we sort of think of something we left behind as a child, or we think of people's hobbies. You know, it's sort of their curiosity. It's usually sort of a trite thing. It's something you dabble in. And the thing that I try to clarify in the book and draw out is that curiosity is it is a way to see the world that God has given us that actually draws out all of the important aspects of life, starting specifically in our relationship with God. The basic premise that if God is an infinite God and we are not infinite, We can't possibly understand him, and yet we're supposed to reflect him. The only way to do that is by deep exploration of who he is. That's the starting point for curiosity. From there, you can go out into the world and you can explore cultures and arts and hobbies and relationships and cities. And I mean, so really any aspect of life, and then the connections begin to build between those things. And so the idea of the book was just sort of born out of really seeing a whole bunch of problems and going, what is the solution for these? Because I don't see much of a point in writing a book unless you're helping people progress past a problem or out of a problem, giving them some sort of a direction. And so I saw conflicts between people in relationship. I saw dividing lines politically, racially, theologically. I saw a whole bunch of Christians who just have flat, boring spiritual lives. And I know that I've struggled with that as well. You just sort of dry up. And these are all consistent things. You just look around every day and you'll see another example of them. So as I began to just sort of mull these things over, it became clear to me that a common thread in all of these was a lack of genuine curiosity that could be a solution to it. So in personal relationship with God, a lack of curiosity dries up your Bible reading and your prayer. In relationships, you become static and bored. In crossing cultures, you fail to understand the people on the other side. In all of those divides, there's a lack of empathy. And so it's hopefully a way to help people find a way forward in all of those. And not just a way forward, but genuine joy and life in them as well.
All right. So you introduce or reintroduce the word wonder, mm-hmm. I think, in this book. And wonder is a word that, you know, you hear from time to time. But I don't know that we really – it's one of those words that is ubiquitous in such a way that we've kind of become desensitized to it. Mm-hmm. So this idea of reintroducing wonder into our lives, the way that can propel us forward. And I'd love to hear more maybe later in our discussion just how you think we get there. But for the purpose of our show, which we talk about groups and group leadership, and thinking about the idea of wonder and its significance in the lives of disciples, how might you suggest that, say, a group leader of any kind take measures to be sure wonder isn't or wasn't lost in the lives of group members?
Yeah. I really like that question because I think it resonates with the thing that I have been frustrated with and when I have been at various points in groups.
Group life.
Because the first thing that came to mind when you sent me that question was group leaders that I have been around tend to major on to-dos. So practical applications, do this, like solutions, and not nearly as much reflection on what God did. And so I think wonder in the life of a group, there has to be an intentional reflection and focus on the things that God has done and is doing. And so just sort of sitting with those, thinking about them, sharing them, chewing on them, so that there is greater wonder in God himself. Because the to-dos, they can be really good things, and most of them are. I mean, I think most group leaders really want to help people. They really want to see people grow. But they're also, it's just one more list of stuff we have to do in the midst of a life full of stuff we have to do. So pausing to think about and be thankful for the things that God has done, I think is essential. And I think there are even ways to phrase that, though, as a group leader. You think about, instead of asking, what have you learned? Because that's a very educational kind of mm-hmm. phrasing. Ask, what have you noticed? Mm-hmm. So that people begin to have eyes to see the things that God is doing. What have you noticed that God is doing in somebody else's life, in your own life, in the world, in the church? Because noticing is a lively thing. When you notice something for the first time, it's kind of like, oh, that's fun. When you learn something, like, you file it away. That's just information. So even phrasing questions like that, like, what have you noticed that God has done? It takes some of the weight off. It's not a right answer. And it brings it to life a little bit. So I think for me, that's sort of the paradigm that I would encourage group leaders to shoot for, is focus more on God did and less on to do.
I tell you, one of the things I've concluded in a few years is that there are times when answers are overrated. So this is when it it was a revelation. It was like Newton's apple, I guess you could say. I was sitting in traffic. Does that ever happen? Not to you, Chris.
No, because I live five minutes from here.
And he loves to tell us that, but probably. Yes.
Yeah, I live 20 miles north, so I've...
That's about a two-hour drive.
Yeah, I try to leave early enough or late enough so it's not, but it can be. Yeah.
I was sitting there and I said, you know, I wonder how much longer I'm going to sit here. And it hit me that the answer didn't change anything.
That's right, yeah. Knowing the answer does not help you, and it might make it worse.
And so your premise is that let's put a little bit more emphasis on the right question.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think especially because part of the amazing thing about having that curious mindset is the connections that it leads. So if I ask Chris, what have you noticed, and you share something, that's just, it could be a minor observation. You just, something about the way that God is moving in your life or has impacted your neighbor or that you saw in creation, you can spark something. You're noticing something sparks something in somebody else. And so, yes, it's much less about having a list of the right answers to a theological question or a biblical question or a moral question, and much more about reveling in the things that God is doing.
Do you think some of it is the fear of questioning our faith? We've been having this discussion a lot with my daughter because she's very intelligent. She has a very curious mind, and she's in a very, what we would call, liberal high school and headed into a liberal college and all of that. And so we've had a lot of conversations about it's okay to have questions about just your faith and God and all of that. But I think a lot of times, you know, group leaders and Christians in general just fear that.
Yeah.
That, oh, we're not supposed to question things. You know, we're just supposed to believe it. So we can't have curiosity. Do you think that plays into it?
Absolutely. And I think, I mean, you get that at the top levels of church leadership where there's sort of a tone set of these are the right answers. These are the safe boundaries for the way that we should think. A group leader is often, you know, a step or two down in sort of the authority in church and is also often, I mean, I've led a small group, and I just know, like, there's often a sense of I'm not quite as equipped as the pastor to answer all of these difficult questions. So if a person in the group raises a hard question, there's sort of what do I do? How do I say? Like, I don't want to say the wrong thing. And I think group leaders, A, should just be confident that if the gospel is true, the question is not going to overwhelm the gospel. Period. It's just not. And so you don't have to know the answer. And one of the best things about curiosity is the humility that it has to come from. Because it just starts with a place of, I don't really know. I'm discovering. And so you can accept a question, you can explore a question, but you're rooted in this faith in the gospel, then that's not going to go anywhere. So you can't really be knocked off your footing, even if you don't have a firm answer. And so you give that person the freedom to explore further in faith, and you give God an opportunity to impact their heart without you feeling like you have to tie everything up perfectly.
Mm, that's good. You mentioned earlier about relationships and curiosity in relationships. Why is it important to have curiosity in your relationships?
Because otherwise they get boring fast. I mean, friendships rarely last a long time. A lot of that is circumstantial, you know, geography, people move. But some of that is just they tend to just dry up. It's hard to put your finger on, like, why you're not friends with somebody you were friends with 5 years ago. Intentional curiosity is a way to maintain relationships and go deeper in them because people are dynamic. Nobody stays the same. So you guys will be different in a week than you are now, and friends of yours will be different in a week than they are now. So curiosity is the thing that helps you stay in touch with who a person is. And then the other thing that it does is it creates an attitude and a heart of empathy. If you are going through something and I'm not a curious person, that's your problem. It's just your problem. I don't totally understand and I don't particularly care. If I come from this place of godly curiosity, your problem becomes a thing that I'm deeply invested in and interested in, and I have questions and I can draw it out and I can begin to understand and put myself in your shoes. And think about a group context. That's where we go from conversations about how was work this week to conversations about fears and frustrations and marital issues and things going on with our kids that have left us frustrated or angry or fearful. And where relationships become meaningful. I'm not interested in conversations about how was work. I spent all week at work. I don't need to talk about it anymore. I'm much more interested in the kinds of friends who are genuinely curious about my life and vice versa. And then I think the other thing is that, so curiosity just, it cuts through the shallowness and keeps things, it keeps things going deeper. Because the other thing is, oftentimes you hit a place and then you plateau in relationship. And curiosity constantly asks, like, what else is there? What else is there about this person? So it remains engaged. And so I think that's true on a one-on-one relationship basis, in a group context. And if one person is curious, it draws out everybody else. Because good questions pull people out of a shell or from behind insecurities because they show that they care.
Chris, I wonder if you remember we asked a question with David Francis, an episode, or a recent episode, about authenticity. Mm-hmm. If curiosity isn't one of the paths to a greater authenticity.
Yeah, no, I was thinking that as well. And I was also thinking about, you know, we've discussed how groups can get too large and that keeps them from being authentic. And I think it goes back to, how can you be curious with a large group? What you're talking about really works well with that kind of, when you break it down to that one-on-three, one-on-four, mm-hmm. kind of, you know, what Robbie Gallaty would call those D groups rather than your large group, because your large group is going to stay at that surface, kind of shallow, just from the natural, you know, way it works.
Yeah.
But you got to go deeper with that curiosity when you get that one-on-three or one-on-four.
Yeah, it works in conversation. It doesn't work as well in, like, presentation,
yep.
which is the larger group is sort of what that, I want to say devolves into, but it morphs into a presentational thing because it's just, there's no relational dynamic amongst big groups.
Yeah, Barnabas talked about invested. He used the term invested. One of the ways that you can be invested in people is with an intentional curiosity. Mm-hmm. I mean, at the sincerest level.
Right. Yeah,
not trying to get scoop necessarily, but to be sincerely curious.
That's a really key distinction, because there's a big difference between curiosity that stems from a place of genuine godliness that seeks to care for somebody else and be in relation to them, and curiosity that seeks to collect information. That's sort of, it's almost voyeuristic, where it leads to gossip, it leads to, your motivation is self, not us, relational, and building somebody else up, which, you know, throughout Paul's epistles, you see that the purpose of everything in the church is to build one another up. It's the law of love. And that's, like, that's the driving force behind curiosity in a group.
I want to ask you about leadership. You do a lot with leadership, and you host a successful podcast we talked about, the 5 Leadership Questions. So in your informed opinion, what are the primary challenges to effective leadership today? What's standing in the way?
I think the two things that come to mind are pride and insecurity. And often they go hand in hand, because insecurity exhibits itself kind of one of two ways. It's either very weak leadership, you know, an inability to make decisions, a waffling, changing directions, or insecurity masks itself with ego and power trip. And that, you know, so it hides behind that. But pride in leadership, is just rampant. I mean, we all struggle with pride. It's a thing that humans struggle with. But when you rise in authority, it is so easy to lose accountability and to then be above accountability. You get to a place where nobody can tell you no. You get to a place where everybody depends on you. And if everybody depends on you, they're going to be very afraid to say, we shouldn't do it that way, because you're their gravy train. Mm. And that's true at the organizational level, but there's also just an unapproachability. So think of a group leader. If there's a sense of pride there, and they have sort of positioned themselves as the expert and everybody else is the learner, how many people in that group are going to feel free to challenge them on an opinion, on a lifestyle, on something that ought to be changed? So I think those are two significant challenges that are character. So, and the answer to both is the same, and it's identity in Christ. If you find your identity in Christ, pride gets removed. because you recognize who you are and who Christ is, and the order gets corrected. And insecurity gets corrected because you know who you are and you know who you are in Christ, and that's a whole different person. And so you get lifted out of those depths of insecurity, and on the other hand, you get knocked down a few pegs as necessary if you're prideful. I think circumstantially change is the other biggest challenge for leaders. Mm. Everything changes so fast. Technology changes fast. Culture changes fast. You know, every trend changes fast. The news that it's not even a news story lasts 72 hours and then we forgot that it ever happened. You know, two weeks ago, the big story was 50 missiles landing in Syria. And now we don't even remember that it happened, you know? That's just... Mm-hmm. And so that's a change is so rapid that as a leader, how do you keep up with it? What do you need to do? And I think that's where things like character and vision and having something that doesn't change becomes profound. Expressions of it might over time, but we are here to do something just rock steady in a group context, in a church context, so that as the world swirls around us, this is a place of calm, it's a place of focus, it's a place of vision, and marked by humility and security, not pride and insecurity.
We have already referenced five leadership questions, which you co-host with Todd Atkins, mm-hmm. which is, congratulations on that. You guys are killing it. Was it 50? It's probably bigger than that now, right? 50,000 listeners a month?
Yeah, I mean, that's sort of where we've peaked. We've had a couple slow months because I switched positions inside Lifeway, and so I had to kind of lay down a few responsibilities for a little while. But we're on the verge of kind of ramping back up, and it's gone surprisingly well.
Yeah, Chris, I wonder what a slow month is for five leadership questions. So every episode you ask the same five questions. Mm-hmm. Who are you learning from? What is the main point of emphasis for your leadership team or self right now, mm-hmm. which to your point you just made? What obstacles are you currently facing in leadership, either in your organization or personally? Mm-hmm. What does leadership in your home look like, which is really interesting? What would you tell your 20-year-old self about preparing to lead? So I wanted to throw this back at you today, all right?
All right, put me back
with
on
that,
the spot.
Yeah, with question number one, who are you learning from right now?
Yeah, I think my go-to way of learning is reading in general. Just partly out of enjoyment and partly just the way my mind works, I've learned best through reading. I would, you know, if I'm online and I click on a link thinking I'm going to get like a blog post and it's a video, I'm out. I don't want to watch the video. I'd rather read it.
I'm the same way. So, I want the show notes.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I want the bullet points. I want that. Just give me the words, not the pictures. So what I'm reading right now is I'm reading Travels with Charlie by John Steinbeck, which is Steinbeck's the best, just the greatest novelist, writer. This isn't a novel, but it's sort of a novelized account of his travels across America in a camper with his dog.
You got two English majors here. You're stepping into some territory.
It's deep.
Steinbeck's good, though.
I'll go with you on that one.
Yeah.
Well, and I just finished Grapes of Wrath before this one, and I was reminded. So I read East of Eden maybe 7 or 8 years ago and had never read any Steinbeck prior to that. Then I read Of Mice and Men. Then I read, then I waited a few years, and then I read Grapes of Wrath in this one. And now I'm just going to go read anything else that he's written that I don't know off the top of my head. I'm reading The Originals by Adam Grant. So it falls into that.
That's
good. Have you read that one? Mm-hmm. So I'm moving very slowly through it because I read 6 books at a time. But I really like the way that he sort of weaves together stories and ideas to sort of draw out trends of what sets apart people who have done truly creative and original things. There's a lot of great leadership principles in there and entrepreneurial principles. I'm reading Boundaries by Henry Cloud and John Townsend.
First time to read that?
It is. I mean, the book's been around for several years and has sold, I don't know, something like 2 or 3 million copies. Yeah. But and it's one of those great books because you don't have to sit there and like read it word for word. You can sort of skip through to the parts that are really pertinent. But some really helpful principles in that one, relationally, work-wise. There's a lot of different things there. I'm reading a biography of Willie Mays by James Hirsch. I love baseball. You guys are both.
Is that recent? Is that a recent biography or is that a standard?
I think it came out about 10 years ago.
He's probably my favorite all time. But I've never read a biography.
Willie Mays?
Yep.
Wow.
He's he's a baseball player who I didn't know anything about, but I mean, one of the top two or three baseball players in history.
Yeah.
The catch, right?
Yeah. Yeah. 54.
Yeah. 600 plus homers, 3,000. I mean, just, yeah, tons
but
of.
But I don't track that kind of stuff.
Yeah. I mean, just not off the top of your head anyway. I see you have Google up there, baseball reference. But it's a really well-written biography. Some biographies are sort of a list of accomplishments, and this is much more of a narrative of his life. Does a really good job. And then I'm reading Garrison Keillor's collection of poems. So it's poems that he collected by other people that they ended up reading on the air over the years of Prairie Home Companion and other radio shows. And so poetry is a thing that I'm sort of beginning to get into. I'm no expert, so I'm just sort of finding my footing and what I like. And as somebody who writes, I love seeing how other people can take words and phrases and just do masterful things with them. So that's just been a pleasure to dig into that. And then other people I'm learning from, I'm a podcast listener like crazy. So listening to How I Built This, which is an NPR podcast.
It's
about
a great podcast.
Yeah, they do such a tightly edited job of that. You know, yep. You don't kind of get lost in a lot of meandering conversation, but it's about how people started what are now very successful endeavors, companies. Let's see what else. I listen to Tim Ferriss's podcast, depending on his guests. I listen to, we were discussing the show S-Town, which some of us really enjoyed and some of us, petered out on. But I love good storytelling.
I don't know if enjoy. It's like some movie. Appreciated. People say, well, did you like it? It's like, well, it's not a movie you really like or not like.
Like Schindler's List. Was that exciting? And
yeah.
Good movie? Well,
12 Years a Slave is one of those. Did you like it? Well. Yeah.
So you appreciated it more than I did, or you found...
How much time we got?
Anyway, that's one. So yeah, I listen to a lot of podcasts. I listen to a lot of the NPR podcasts. There's one called Song Exploder I really like. It's by musicians basically dissect their own songs, and they show how they built it layer by layer. So it's another one of just seeing the creative process of people. And most of them are musicians I've never heard of because I'm not a big music guy, but fascinating podcast. So those are just some of the ways I try to constantly have something either in front of my face or in my ears that's teaching me something.
Six books at one time. Is that a constant number or is that just right now? How do you make that decision? Are they genres?
I try to scatter my genres. And so like something business, something biblical, something fiction, something
consumptive.
Yeah, something historical. And then, you know, poetry is a new thing to add in there. And so if I ever get down to like three books, I kind of get the shakes because there's not enough on my bedside table. So then I got to work back up to, you know, four, five or six.
I've got the same thing, but I need to work on the category because people always tell me you need to read fiction. I'm like, I don't have time for fiction. But if you can read fiction, it expands your mind. It helps your writing. I mean, I know all of that.
Here's the great thing. I say I'm reading some of these. I'm actually listening to a couple of them because I don't have – time is always in short supply. So an Audible subscription where you can just get your one book a month, that's where I consume a lot of the fiction.
One and a half speed or do you keep it at one
speed? I go one and a quarter. One and a half sounds a little chipmunkish, but one and a quarter just compresses the pauses. And so it just it's comfortable.
I do the same thing except I go in order. That's the reason I asked that question. I can't have more than one book at one time. I have to go in order, but it does round the genres, historical, leadership, business,
and
fiction, nonfiction.
I'm fickle, so I need like a buffet.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
I never know what I'm going to be in the mood for when I get my kids to bed and I sit down to read and I'm like, well, what do I want to read tonight? I need to have options.
So, you know, I want to have, you know, The Secret History of Wonder Woman. I want to have that in my hands as little as possible so you read it and get it out.
And not in public.
Did I say that out loud?
I think you may have not wanted to say that on a podcast. That's syndicated.
That's right. I forget.
It's tweetable, too.
I forget.
And I'm going to get a photo of it at some point.
All right. So what are the shortcomings in group leadership or even church leadership, Barnabas, today? Are you seeing leadership within churches and groups better today than ever before? Given because you talk to an array of people all the time from different walks. So what are some things you're picking up that may apply to group leadership today?
I think in a lot of ways, leadership is stronger than it has been in recent decades, because it's a thing that people no longer look at it and go, leadership is for the experts. So you have to achieve a certain degree or credential. You can simply develop as a good leader now. And I think that's a really positive thing, that that people with abilities that God has given them can develop as leaders and don't see a ceiling because they're not a seminary grad or because, you know, whatever credential is there. So I think in a lot of ways, leadership is growing. I think the amount of information about leadership, the books, the blogs, the podcasts. I mean, if we just started rattling off podcasts that we have listened to or that we do, I mean, it would be, we could go for a few minutes. And that's just one medium. So all of that is a good thing. But every good thing kind of has another side of the coin. And I think one of the weaknesses in leadership is too much exposure. It's hard for leaders, aspiring leaders, growing leaders, to be focused. I have worked under leaders. We've all worked under leaders, have seen leaders, you know, worked alongside them, who every time they read a leadership book, they change direction. Because there's a new strategy, there's a new best practice, there's new something. So you come into a staff meeting and like, today we're going to try this. And you're like, but that, 2 weeks ago we were trying something else. And that's a weakness of leadership, because instead of being able to synthesize all these good ideas and find sort of the core, instead of having that identity of who we are as an organization, as a ministry, who I am as a leader, they're constantly grabbing the next best thing. And I think that's so they've taken this good thing, all of this wonderful information, and sort of been lost in it. And I think that's a consistent challenge. I think the other thing is that because of this rise in leadership possibilities, there's also a rise in comparison. It's really, really hard to be comfortable and confident in where you are because you know about how everybody else is doing. Social media has shrunk the world. We know exactly how every other church is doing, about their attendance, about how many people were baptized, about the number of people who showed up at their extravaganza on Easter, about how many new groups they started this week. I mean, if you want the information, it's at your fingertips, all of which can make you feel inadequate, but none of which actually says you're inadequate. Those are just somebody else's successes, or they're somebody else's numbers. They might not be actual successes. That's the last thing I would say, is that I think leadership and success is increasingly measured by metrics, but the things that matter most are not numeric. And thinking in a group's context, the health of a group, the health of a church's group life, is not measured in the number of groups started, but in the depth of the change in the lives of the people in the groups. How do you put a number on that? I don't think anybody's figured it out. And when you start to put numbers on it, you begin measuring tangential things. You know, number of people who, you know, you measure giving, you measure Bible reading, you measure baptisms, all of which matter. I don't want to downplay those things. But it's easier to just look at numbers than it is to look at these other transformative life things. And so I think for leaders, the weakness is to be overly metrics driven and not wading in the deeper waters of how are people's lives.
I was reading the Fortune magazine on leadership. Did you read that by any chance?
I didn't read that one. No.
Yeah, that's just advice. Theo Epstein was one
of the. Just trying to make me feel dumb.
I don't think I'm going to be able to do that.
I'm feeling like we're comparing ourselves to each other, and I'm on the short end of that stick because I didn't read that one.
Well, he's going baseball here.
So. Yeah, okay. I do know Theo Epstein. Good. With that.
Yeah, going because Theo Epstein was in. He may have been number one, but he
number
was
number one leader. Yeah.
Yeah, he was number one.
I read that article.
Yeah. So you read it. So Chris, let me get that right. So you read it as well.
I did read
I'm
it.
A failure. All right.
So there's two of us in the room that read it,
and that would be. No.
Only one of us is verified on Twitter, though.
But was
another metric that doesn't mean anything.
What was interesting about the article is that, you know, baseball has moved and has been moving towards the analytics, and NBA is huge in that now. Yep. And I guess
Houston
they all
Rockets.
Are. Yeah, I guess they all. I don't hear as much about it with football, but I'm sure it's there. NBA and baseball.
Football is so stylistically varied that the metrics are much harder to play out. And I know this because I love sports statistics. Like, I'll nerd out on those. And so, in as a football fan, I've kind of looked for it there, and there's just there's so much more variance.
At some point, numbers don't tell the story anymore.
Right.
And Epstein says that I can't remember how he puts it, Barnabas, but he basically says we got to the point where we couldn't take the analytics any farther. You read it. You probably remember the point that he made, and they want to corner the market on character, which has no analytic. But then again, maybe it does. I don't know. It was just interesting that here's the guy, because for those of you that don't know,
Moneyball.
Epstein was like 28 years old when he took the Red Sox to the World Series. And I remember thinking, 28?
He
28?
He built the team that broke Boston's curse.
Yeah.
Yep.
He built it. And he did the same thing with the Cubs for the most part. So here's a guy.
Now Cleveland needs to hire him.
Yeah. That's right. So if anybody has a reason to believe in the numbers, it's Theo Epstein.
Right.
And here he is, the person that's saying, you know, we've done that, and it served us well, but I'm wondering now if we don't need to corner the market and be the best or the first in understanding character. It's a good story.
Yeah, and you even see that, because when the Cubs won the World Series, their team leader was a fairly mediocre baseball player. David Ross was sort of one of the glue guys that held that team together. He's 38 years old at the time. He was his last season. He's a part-time player and wasn't very good, to be frank, statistically. But he lifted the level of the people around him in terms of focus and all of the aspects of the game that are harder to measure. And
presence.
Yeah, just presence and overcoming adversity as somebody with experience who's like, it's okay, guys. We're going to make it. It's going to be all right. And all those things. And so, yeah, you see the character aspect, whereas he doesn't hit like Chris Bryant or Kyle Schwarber, but he's the guy who sort of put them in a position to succeed in a lot of ways.
So what do you think about – there's been a big debate in the last few weeks about platform building for leaders. what are your thoughts? Because – to some degree, and it goes back to that pride issue that you're talking about, that if you're going to be a leader that kind of makes a dent, you're going to have pride. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's some pride, and you're going to have to build a platform. But there's this debate on, you know, should you, and you're living this because you write books. I wrote a book, and they told me you got to build your platform.
Right.
So what are your thoughts on that?
I have a real love-hate relationship with the idea of platform. The upside of the concept of platform is that with numeric growth, so Twitter followers, Facebook fans, just numeric reach, the idea is that you have the potential for greater impact. I also know that every time a person has tried to build their own impact, it has been a little mini Tower of Babel scenario. And I know this in my own life. Like, when I am tempted to be numbers focused, I'm building my kingdom, not God's. And so, and I realize that from the outside, this could look very disingenuous because I have an okay Twitter following and I write things and I share them on the web. And so I am in some ways promoting the things that I do. But what I want to be able to do is share the things that I believe in, not promote the work that I do for my sake. I don't want to build a kingdom in my image. Because that's a big temptation. And I think for pastors, it's just as much of a temptation. A church is a platform.
Yep.
It shouldn't be. Like, that's not the way it should be thought of, but it is. The idea of moving from a mid-sized church to a large-sized church and calling it, like, I was called to this church. No, you took a better job. That's not the same thing. You know, and it's not wrong, but just call it what it is. You took a better job.
Yep.
And with the better job comes the potential for a bigger platform. And the only way that that's not a harmful thing is if you decrease and Christ increases. And that's like, that's the bottom line in all of it. And so for me, I have more and more tried to tilt myself towards the idea of, I want to create the right kind of work. And if God wants it to get big, the numbers are up to him. I don't want to chase Twitter followers. I don't want to chase Facebook followers. I don't want to navigate my way onto some bestsellers list. I would love it if I ended up on a bestsellers list. I'm not going to lie. But that's not a thing I want to try to engineer, because I think when we try to engineer our own success and our own fame and our own platform, we're just playing into the hands of pride.
That's good. I want to ask you, according to informal research about the trends of evangelicalism, which I can never say right, but I think I got close enough.
You did a good job. I was impressed.
Thank you so much. I did read that Forbes article, though. So, a current cultural plague is anxiety or fear of the very unknown future. So I would describe this paradigm as something akin to disorientation. So how are you seeing this played out in your circles?
I think it's a very sort of nebulous, open-ended question. The ways that I see this anxiety being played out most is in the social media realm, or at least sort of through the realm of social media, because we live in a time where you know about every crisis going on in the world on the one hand, and you know about every person's success on the other hand. So you, in 30 seconds, you can see the worst thing happening in the world and the best thing happening in somebody else's life. That's disorienting. And it doesn't give you any sense of who you are, where you are, or what God wants of you. And this isn't to say that social media is not a good thing. I love social media. But you have to have a real sense of what you're wading into. Otherwise, it sweeps you away in its tide. So I think the problems of insecurity and anxiety and this sort of disorientation are really exacerbated by that just profound overexposure to stuff that we don't have any business knowing. You know, 15 years ago, there was a newspaper, and there was, you know, the internet wasn't really a news source yet, and there was evening newscasts, and even that felt overwhelming, because I know people, I mean, I remember being in high school and people saying, oh, I don't watch the news, it's all bad news. I'm like, well, goodness sakes, don't get on Twitter.
It's on for an hour a day at
right.
the time.
Yeah. Yeah. You got your local news for 30 minutes and your national news for right. 30 minutes, and then you move into like the 2020s and whatever else, yeah. 60 minutes and all those. So it's, but now it's constant, which leaves us constantly wondering, what problems are we supposed to attack? What is my place in all of this? Am I supposed to be as successful as those other people? When are those problems going to hit my life? And we lose our sense of presence, our sense of place, our sense of relationship. All of that just disappears in this swirl of social media. It's not just social media, just multimedia
right.
input. And so I think that's where I see it most, and especially amongst younger Christians, because everybody's cause-oriented, which is not a bad thing. They want to change the world, but they want to solve all the world's problems. 15 years ago, we didn't know what all the world's problems were. We could just find the ones in our neighborhood, or that our church was invested in with that lost people group, or this homeless shelter, or whatever. Now it's, I know all of the homeless shelters.
It's awareness. It's all about awareness.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, over awareness. And so there's, yeah, it just completely overwhelms our senses, and that's not the way God designed us. We were not designed to care about the entire world's problems. That's His responsibility. Mm. Ours are to care for the people in our relational circle.
Well, Barnabas, that is fantastic. I know you're busy, so thank you for being with us today. How about we do it again?
I would love to.
We'll do a sports show maybe next time. Oh. We got close this time.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, you guys both read about Theo Epstein, and I didn't, so now I got some catching up to do.
He's got homework.
Short. Yep. I'll do.
Seven. It's number seven.
All right.
You have six books. Add the article.
Fair enough.
The Curious Christian, How Discovering Wonder Enriches Every Part of Life, is available at Lifeway.com, and I'm sure other large retailers.
I hope it's available at all the large retailers, because I'm not opposed to selling books despite my opposition to platform.
In Kentucky, we called that a quandary. Check out Happy Rant and Five Leadership Questions, which are both excellent, excellent shows. So you need to check that out. And also you can find out more about Barnabas at barnabaspiper.com. Chris, that's going to wrap it up for episode 45.
Yep.
And we are sponsored by, once again,
smallgroup.com, which has over 3,000.
300?
Nope, 3,000. Ryan, studies that you can customize for your context, for your church, your ministry. Check it out. Go to smallgroup.com and get a 30-day free. You don't get anything free for 30 days, but you do at smallgroup.com. So, you know, Netflix, you get like 7 days. You get 30 days. So go check it out. See how it works for you.
And thanks for checking out the Groups Matter podcast, episode 45. We look forward to being with you again on episode 46. And we would be remiss, very remiss, if we did not thank Drew Porterfield, our producer. Look forward to being with you guys again. Once again, Barnabas, thank you so much.
Thank you.